There are various threads in Acts chapter 22, and not the least of the interest of the threads is the consistent errors of judgment of the Roman chief captain. Now, the Roman chief captain was supposed to be experienced enough not to make those sort of errors, particularly in a volatile community like Jerusalem. But we see here that he does make a number of errors, and I'll try and pick those out to you as we come. But the first of them came just before the end of the previous chapter. He assumed that Paul was that Egyptian who had led 4,000 murderers and assassins out into the desert. It would appear that this particular rising was a group of men who carried short swords with them under their robes and murdered selected people when they came up to the festival for such occasions as the Pentecost. And therefore, the chief captain assumed that this man that they were all rioting about had come secretly back. He'd left the 4,000 in the wilderness and come back himself, you see, to Jerusalem to create havoc and trouble, and that the crowd had spotted him and realised who it was. And this was his assumption, you see. And of course, the crowd was very insistent. He hadn't got round to anything like a trial or anything like establishing the matter. So that when Paul said to him, in Greek, Paul spoke to him and said, "May I speak unto thee?" He was surprised, because he thought this man was an Egyptian, and that being an Egyptian, he would possibly not know Greek so well as Paul obviously spoke it. Undoubtedly, everybody would know Greek in those days, unless they were very uneducated, and even an Egyptian, because the Old Testament was first translated from Hebrew into Greek in Alexandria, so Egyptians knew Greek. It wasn't that sort of question, but clearly he spoke it much better. This was an educated man, and there is reason to think that this Egyptian was not. So he was very surprised when Paul asked him, "May I speak unto thee? Art thou not that Egyptian which before these days made us an uproar and led us out into the wilderness, 4,000 men that were murderers?" And Paul says, "No, I'm a man which am a Jew of Tarsus, a city in Cilicia, and I beseech thee, suffer me to speak unto the people." He doesn't at this point say he's a Roman. Now, the chief captain ought to have known the status of Tarsus in Cilicia, that it was had been granted freedom, and as having been granted freedom by a former Roman governor, then that it ought to be that a citizen of that country would be a Roman. He ought to have been alerted to that fact, you see. And in all the kerfuffle, in all that was going on, he didn't get that right. So it's just a little reminder to us that in the midst of all the comings and goings and the panics and all the pressures of life, it's very easy to make those errors of judgment that we as Christian people would not expect to make, really. Things that our prayer would have prepared us for, and so we don't go off down a wrong track. And while it does not seem that there was any comeback for this man for the errors that he makes, I mean, today's modern society where once a thing is there, you're pilloried for everything you do, he was in grave danger, as we shall see, of being held to account for his actions here. But he's kind enough to Paul. When he'd given him license, Paul stood on the stairs and beckoned with his hand unto the people. Now, he's still in chains. And so I presume the Roman soldier went up with him, you know, and he beckoned to the people. Now, again, can you get a picture of this? Here was a crowd that had been so full of commotion that they'd had to drag Paul out from the midst of them for trying to put him to death. Wrongly. Mob law, mob rule, mob violence. And though the Holy Spirit isn't here mentioned, Paul puts up his hand and the crowd falls pretty silent. And then he speaks to them in the Hebrew language. Now, Hebrew had gone out some 200 years. This would be Aramaic, I'm pretty certain. But he speaks to them in that. And they fall absolutely silent. Now, imagine the effect on the chief captain. He's spoken to him in Greek, and he was quite surprised. He's given him permission to speak. The crowd has hushed suddenly, and now he doesn't know what he's talking about, because he's speaking in a language that he doesn't know. He could be saying anything. He could be now inciting these men to violence. And yet there was enough about the manner of Paul that made him fairly confident that that isn't what was happening. So now picture that all that is going on is welcome to the Jews because it's in their language, but completely foreign to the Roman who's in charge. Can you imagine him? He looks at Paul and he looks at the crowd to see that they're in order, and he doesn't understand a thing. He must wonder to himself, what are they doing? What's happening here? Is the crowd getting restive? Are they planning a... You can just see all the things that might be going on just at this particular time, you see. And there was a great silence. Can you imagine? You could hear a pin drop where there'd been this... the same man, the same crowd. And again, we're reminded that crowds that act simply because somebody has made a suggestion and the word's gone around like wildfire, crowds do things that wouldn't be done if there was rational thought and a time to think about these things. So from being a mad crowd, it's silence. It's going to be a mad crowd again. But just for the time being, there's a great silence, a great hush. Because Paul is able to bear testimony to this unruly crowd. Although it brings great trouble, he bears testimony. Now, we don't know if anybody was saved as a result of this. And often it is that when the gospel is preached, it is the savour of death unto death. It would seem that the majority who heard on this occasion were hostile. And one commentator, it's the only commentator that I've come across, points out that you can read the story like we did last week of the Jewish, of the Christian gathering in Jerusalem, and see that really it was very lukewarm, the welcome they gave to Paul. And whereas in other places the Christians rally round and support, like they did with Sosipater and others in other places, there is no mention of the Jerusalem church coming to help Paul at all in any of the subsequent events. Not when he goes before the council, not here, not anywhere. And it does look as if there was quite strong feeling against his Gentile approach. And it was not, at least, the church did not appear to have the courage of their convictions to stand against it, when you bear in mind that the crowd heard them until he mentioned the word Gentiles. So it probably was not expedient for the Jerusalem church to show that they were on the side of Paul. But if so, that would have been shameful. But it wasn't so much that as it seemed that they were not doctrinally convinced yet that this is what Paul... But Paul was teaching Jews, you see, not to be circumcised. Well, he could teach Gentiles not to be circumcised. There was no need to be circumcised. But they alleged to him that it was a rather different matter that he was teaching Jews, that Jewishness was no longer necessary. And that battle has not been finished today. You get Jewish enclaves of Jewish Christians everywhere who insist that to be Christians among a Jew, you've got to go through all the Jewish thing, you see. And they understand that the Gentiles don't need to do that, which was the first battle the early church fought. But they think that they should do it as part of their culture. And that was where Jerusalem church would appear to have gone wrong. But it does appear that their support, to put it mildly, was very lukewarm for Paul and for Silas. So now Paul begins his defence. Now, he gives his testimony about what happened on the Damascus Road here. We have it when the event took place in chapter 9. We have it later when he recounts it before the governor. And we have it here. And it's quite a useful thing to line up the three accounts and to see what's here. But what you always have to remember in this is that Paul here is speaking for a particular purpose and only draws in the relevant details. In other words, like a good teacher, there may be many other things he'd like to say, but at that juncture it was not the thing to say. He was selecting his facts for the cause in hand, namely to be able to subdue this crowd, to explain who he was, to explain the reason why he was doing what, to give an account of the gospel and why it was to be taken to the Gentiles. But everything was subservient to that. I mean, we may have got a very truncated version. It may have taken half an hour. And you can read this in a matter of 5 minutes. Maybe there was more than what we have recorded here. But clearly the Paul selected his details to ram home the points he was making. And other things that you have in the account of his conversion in chapter 9 and in chapter 26, these things are not, they're consistent with each other, but the same facts aren't always mentioned. And there's one particular fact mentioned here about his conversion that isn't, I think, mentioned in either of the other two, and we'll come to that. So first of all, he's going to say to them that he is not that Egyptian, and he's going to say to them that he has no truck with bringing Gentiles into the temple. All these things are far from who he is, what he is. Now, he is different from what he used to be as a Christian, but he traces that. Men, brethren, and fathers. Now, can you think? So it's you. Here you are, you've been manhandled in Ipswich, you've been preaching the gospel, the police have come along, everybody's come along, and they've rescued you. You said to the policeman, you're battered and bruised a bit, and perhaps a bit scared, and perhaps a bit taken on. And you said to the police, can I address this vast crowd that have been over? And when he gets up on his feet, he says, brethren, meaning Jewish, not Christian brethren. Brethren, fathers. He knew that members of the council were there, the Sanhedrin. They were totally opposed to what he was doing. But he speaks. If he were dishevelled, as he may well have been, if he'd been roughened up, you look at the dignity of this speech. In the middle of all that trouble. Now, if difficult days are coming, if they are, and if our children will need to know things and go through things that we've never had to go through, it would be good to school them in this, how Paul coped in that situation. No rancour, no malice, tough doctrine, but courteous, even in that situation. Men, brethren, and fathers. Now, not only the fact that he spoke in the Hebrew language, but the fact that he addressed them in the time-honoured way that no unschooled Jew would know how to do it, obviously contributed to the silence. Men, brethren, and fathers, hear ye my defence, which I make now unto you. When they heard that he spake in the Hebrew tongue to them, they kept them more silent. So he couldn't make it more powerful, could he? In verse 40, Luke records, when there was made a great silence, he spake unto them. Verse 2, when they heard that he spake in the Hebrew tongue to them, they kept them more silence. Could hear a pin drop in that vast crowd. I am verily a man which am a Jew. I am a Jewish man. First and foremost. As far as that crowd is concerned, he says, you see, to the Lord, I am a gospel preacher, but I'm all things to all men, that I may win some. So here he doesn't stress that. He will stress it very powerfully that he is a Christian, but here he begins by establishing a rapport with this vast crowd of hostile people. When we're teaching, of course, teaching the gospel to people who don't know it or whatever, first of all, you have to establish a rapport. You have to establish common ground. Just begin with something where they can follow you and take. Otherwise, the lot is over their heads. I certainly remember my early days of preaching. I had a good preacher. But before I was converted in those early days, much of what was said went over my head because there'd been no point of reference. By the time you get a point of reference and can work out all the other things that are being said, perhaps much has gone that you would otherwise have got. So if a point of reference can be established straight away, that is useful. Well, I'm a man which am a Jew, born in Tarsus, a city in Cilicia, yet brought up in this city at the feet of Gamaliel. Now, that was top-class reference. Gamaliel was not only the senior man of the time, but most would think that even over a course of 400 or 500 or 600 or 700 or 800 years, Gamaliel would be one of the three or four greatest teachers. So he has impeccable university education, so to speak, at Jerusalem. I read somewhere, and I've no idea how true it is, but the sort of general guess is that he came to Jerusalem aged somewhere between 8 and 14. But of course Gamaliel, as well says, didn't teach boys. He taught men, so we're thinking of Paul as a young man of 20 or something like that, probably. But he sat at the feet of Gamaliel, and that expression we understand well enough. I think actually they did literally sit at the feet of their rabbis, this man was called a rabban. And that was a title that was only given perhaps to two in any generation. And the next one down was rabbi, and the next one down was rab. But this man was known as a rabban. So he knows what he's talking about, is what's coming across to this crowd. And they know he knows what he's talking about. And he's addressing, of course, the whole crowd. But he has the Sanhedrin, the 70 of them, all scattered in that crowd. They're not met in official meeting. They're probably not all standing together, but he knows they're all there. And they would know what he was talking about, as he will draw attention to in a minute. Brought up in this city at the feet of Gamaliel, and taught according to the perfect manner of the law of the fathers. And here's a lovely touch. It's a touch, if you like, of vulnerability, a touch against himself. But it's a marvellous touch with the crowd. According to the perfect manner of the law of the fathers, and was zealous toward God as ye all are this day. Well, you come for me, but he's going to explain how he went for Christians 20 years previously. So we're of one ilk, he says. We're of one ilk. As ye all, you're all keen for God. Look what you've done to me. But I did that sort of thing too. I understand it well enough. See what he's doing? And I persecuted this way. Technical term for Christians, but they all know what he meant. The people of the way. I persecuted this way unto the death. Now, it's easy to miss, I think, but when he went to Damascus, we are told in a number of places, Paul tells us twice, Luke tells us on the other occasion in commenting, that he actually brought Christians to death. His intention was to hail men and women to be beaten in the synagogues, which was lawful for Jews. If they didn't like it, they could beat people in the synagogues. But some he brought, and they did die. That seems to be. So Paul was a terrible persecutor, and he killed the Christians. Sometimes if the thought arises to us, you know, what's it going to be like in heaven if somebody whose loved one has been murdered by somebody who's there? But it's so with Paul. Stephen and Paul presumably get on well together now in the glory, if you see what I mean. I persecuted this way unto the death. Binding, that means putting chains around them. Binding and delivering into prisons both men and women. He took no notice of the fair sex, didn't care who they were. If they were believers, he would bring them bound, even all the way from Damascus, even all the way to Jerusalem, in order that they should be beaten in the synagogues, brought before the Sanhedrin, and if they could get away with putting them to death, as the hint is that he did, but perhaps he particularly has Stephen in mind, then that's what he did. As also the high priest doth bear me witness. Now in the next chapter we're going to find that he didn't recognise the current high priest. And we don't think he was being ironic. He called him a whited wall, and somebody slapped his face and said, you shouldn't revile the high priest. He said, sorry, I didn't know it was the high priest. Now, he might have been saying that he wasn't acting like the high priest. And of course he wouldn't be in his robes because he wasn't officiating. But maybe Paul, they could come and go and change every year. Not necessarily, but they could. So when he says here, as also the high priest does bear me witness, what he's speaking of is the Sanhedrin records. Not the high priest of the current time, who might not have been party to it 20 years ago. But if you can imagine the Sanhedrin of 70 elders, not necessarily the oldest men, but let's say if some started on the place when they were 40, 45, they could still be there 20 years later. Some of the current members of the Sanhedrin would have been there when Paul asked for letters from Damascus officially for them. But they would have had a record that Paul had been granted official permission to go to Damascus and bring any Christians he found back. They would have had a record of that, you see. And so it is, as he says. And I persecuted this way unto the death, binding and delivering into prisons both men and women, as also the high priest doth bear me witness, and all the estate of the elders. That's another way for saying the Sanhedrin. The 70 Sanhedrin. From whom also I received letters unto the brethren. These brethren are the Jews, not the Christian brethren, the Jews. And I went to Damascus. I read somewhere recently, and there's no reason to think it's not true, that Damascus to this day is the oldest continually inhabited city in the world. I mean, it's still with us today. Hasn't been destroyed. There's not been a time when it hasn't functioned. And it was quite old in those days too. But that Damascus is the oldest inhabited city in the world is just a fact that I filed away that I read not very long ago. Well, I received letters unto the brethren and went to Damascus to bring them which were there bound unto Jerusalem for to be punished. Now, the Christian Institute fight for Christianity in this country, which has become instituted, but can you imagine if it happened here? That they send out people from London into every place to find the Christians in all the places and bring them in chains to be punished in London? You can see what he's saying, can't you? That's what it was like to be a Christian there and then, 20 years before the time he's speaking. And it came to pass that as I made my journey and was come nigh unto Damascus, about noon, and this is the, so far as I'm aware, I didn't look at it today, but I have looked at it before, so to the best of my recollection, noon is not mentioned in either of the other two accounts. You can check it out for yourself and see if I'm right. But the significance of mentioning noon must dawn on you, as it doubtfully dawned on them. As I made my journey and was come nigh unto Damascus about noon, suddenly there came from heaven a great light. What, at noon? A light that would swamp noontide light? Suddenly begin to get aware of. A light that made him blind, of course. Well, you could do that by looking at the sun, which nobody would think of doing. But a light brighter by far than a noonday light in a Middle Eastern country. You see the point he's making anyway, which isn't made anywhere else as far as I recall. But it's opposite to his point here, you see. He wants to make them see that God is in this. The great God, the light giver, the creator, the one who made the sun, the moon and the stars. Suddenly there shone from heaven a great light round about me, and I fell to the ground and heard a voice saying unto me, Saul, Saul, why persecutest thou me? And I answered, Who art thou, Lord? And he said unto me, I am Jesus of Nazareth, whom thou persecutest. Had it not been for this dramatic thing, Paul needed that to convert him. If he'd just gone on in the way he'd been, he would never have been changed. So we must never despair that the Lord will change whom he wishes, when he wishes, and how he wishes. And here in verse 9, they that were with me saw indeed the light and were afraid, but they heard not the voice of him that spake to me. Now, the other records speak of them hearing a voice, and it confuses people. The voice they heard was Paul saying, Who art thou, Lord? They didn't hear the voice from heaven, but they heard Paul's reply. So when you read in the other accounts that they heard the voice, and here it says they didn't, it's quite explicit here, isn't it? They heard not the voice of him that spake to me, but they certainly heard the voice, they heard me speaking. And I said, What shall I do, Lord? And the Lord said unto me, Arise and go into Damascus, and there it shall be told thee of all things which are appointed for thee to do. I mean, right from this stage, the appointment of Paul is coming across to him, into his heart. He's blinded, he can't, but the Lord has appointed something for him. And in Damascus, he's going to hear it. It's not the appropriate moment. Just like it's not appropriate to preach to a drunk in the gutter necessarily, but you may give him a Bible, like to Dr. Allen, who afterwards he went and read. So the Lord tells him at this situation that there are things to do, but now is not the time to tell you about it. And when I could not see for the glory of that light, Now, this was quite literal, but we sometimes think there are things that we do not understand about God for the glory of the light. It's not that the glory isn't there, but we don't see this glory. And that glory only appeared to him on that occasion, and perhaps when he was caught up into heaven, seventh heaven. But here, he says he saw that light. And of course, it is a symbol of seeing the light. People use that expression in that way. Perhaps a bit unfairly, because lots of people have seen the light, but it doesn't happen like this. But yes, it does symbolise that. And he says, "Arise and go into Damascus. And when I could not see for the glory of that light, being led by the hand of them that were with me, I came into Damascus." I wonder what the people who were with him thought now. They've gone with him in order to help him bring back the crowds of people in chains. And now they're leading him by the hand, like a little boy might lead a blind person. Because he's been blinded, and they didn't hear the voice that spoke to him, but they did hear something. They heard what they could see that something had gone on. And one Ananias, now he speaks like this, because he knows that there will be many in the crowd who know of or who knew Ananias. Now Ananias was a converted Jew. He was a brother in the faith. But he's appealing to them. They're knowledge of him as a thoroughgoing proper Jew. That's the thrust of what he's saying, you see. But clearly, he's saying that he's a Christian because he says, "Brother Saul," once heard Fousey preach on the text, "Brother Saul." How it comes to a person who's just been saved that he's immediately taken up into the brethren and someone addresses him as Brother Saul. Well, there we are. One Ananias, a devout man according to the law, having a good report of all the Jews which dwelt there. That's the point he's making. I'm sound. I am a true Israelite. I come of a Jewish background. I would not bring Gentiles into the temple. I am not that Egyptian. I am not in favour of assassinations. All this is what's being said, you see, under here. So Ananias is a devout man according to the law. I've only dealt with devout men according to the law, he's saying, really. Having a good report of all the Jews which dwelt there, came unto me and stood and said unto me, "Brother Saul, receive thy sight." And the same hour I looked up upon him, I could see again. Then he said, you can read the account earlier in the book, "The God of our fathers hath chosen thee, that thou shouldest know his will." Now you can understand how when he writes 1 Corinthians, God has chosen the meek of the earth, the base of the earth, the things that are not. But his love of the expression chosen, because it came across to him right from the very beginning of his salvation. "The God of our fathers hath chosen thee, that thou shouldest know his will." But he didn't know it before, for all his expertise in Orthodox Judaism and sitting under the feet of Gamaliel. Now, can you see, begin to feel, that though he's making a good fist of this, already the crowd would begin to go restive. Now, he's talking in Aramaic, and the Roman leader, chief captain, is looking on and seeing that it's not, it was silent, but it's getting a little restive now. People are spotting that he's talking about Brother Saul. He's talking about the Christian way. He's talking about the light that happened to him, how he was changed, how he was orthodox like they were, and how he was brought up Gamaliel, but he's reneged on that. As a, you know, there's this general feeling is now beginning to build up again. Hostility. "The God of our fathers hath chosen thee, that thou shouldest know his will." Didn't they all know his will? No, they didn't, but they thought they did, you see. You can just sense the thing. "And see that just one, the Lord Jesus, and shouldest hear the voice of his mouth. For thou shalt be his witness unto all men of what thou hast seen and heard." I saw a bright light, but then I was blinded. "And now," this is Ananias, "why tarriest thou? Arise and be baptized and wash away thy sins." That isn't meant to suggest that he should be baptized and then wash away his sins. Rather that would be the external witness of all who knew him as an Orthodox Jew that his life had changed and that the change had happened, his sins had been pardoned, and now he would be baptized, calling on the name of the Lord. And now he jumps over a few years. "And it came to pass that when I was come again to Jerusalem, even while I prayed in the temple, I was in a trance. The Greek word is ecstasy, but it does mean not trance as we would think of it today, but a sort of dream, dreamlike, a waking dream probably is the best thing. But the Lord was speaking to him, and saw him saying unto me, make haste and get thee quickly out of Jerusalem, for they will not receive thy testimony concerning me. Can you imagine the crowd getting still more restive? The Jews 20 years ago in Jerusalem would not receive. The testimony would be against God. They will not receive thy testimony concerning me. So they're going to believe against God. You can imagine the crowd now getting uncomfortable. And here, Paul gives a little insight into his conversation with God. Now, I'm often saying to you, when you pray, do not be afraid to reason with the Lord. It's not insulting to God, and it's not blasphemous. Paul here is sorting things out in his mind. He doesn't mean to contradict God. He's merely putting the other point of view so that the Lord can come back to him and assure him of the truth. And you must be able to do this in your prayers. You must be able to say, well, now, if these things are true in the scripture, but this situation faces me, how do I respond to it? And you bring the points, like you would anybody. Well, I said, Lord, they know. Surely they will receive my testimony, is what he's getting at. You say, they won't receive the testimony. Get out of Jerusalem quickly. But surely, Lord, they know I was in prison. They know I beat in the synagogue, in synagogue by synagogue, every synagogue, it means synagogue by synagogue, that I imprisoned and beat in every synagogue those that believed in me. They know that. They'll receive the testimony, won't they? And when the blood of thy martyr, or thy witness, martyr there is beginning to have its new meaning. The word martyr is taken letter by letter from the Greek word martyr, which simply means a witness. But it here means a witness who sealed his witness with death, and that's the meaning it's come to have in modern English. And probably this is the first time it's used in that way. And when the blood of thy martyr Stephen was shed, I also was standing by and consenting unto his death, and kept the raiment of them that slew him. They'll know I did these things. They won't be that opposed. And he said unto me, depart. Books. No argument. But he doesn't rebuke Paul for responding in that way. He needs to be told for certain what he's to do. I mean, you talk to children about things you want them to do, and they come back to you and they have a question. Well, the question is irrelevant, and you just say, no, you get on with it. And it's that sort of thing. But there's nothing wrong in the conversation that Paul has with God, in his prayerfully seeking to do that which is right. And when you're dealing with a God who is unseen and eternal, you do want to be assured that it's not just something in your own mind. Now, he was having a vision. He actually saw the pool of Jesus Christ coming, but we don't get that. So we are all the more needful to be able to talk to the Lord like that. We read the passage from the scripture, we understand in it that there's something that we should do that we've not seen before, and it means a change of lifestyle or a change of plan. So we check out with the Lord that this is what it really does mean for us at this time. There's nothing wrong with doing that, you see. And he said, depart, for I will send thee far hence unto the Gentiles. And they gave him audience unto this word, and then they lifted up their voices and said, away with such a fellow from the earth. It isn't fit that he should live. And as they cried out and cast off their clothes and threw dust in the air, the chief captain commanded him to be brought into the castle. So in fact, we're going to finish tonight where we finished last week. He's about to be taken again into the castle. And all this has happened. Now, this thing, and they cried out and cast off their clothes into the air. It's quite funny, really. What the Jews did, of course, they threw their clothes at the feet of Paul so they could throw better to stone Stephen. Okay. The trouble is, where they were, there were no stones. So they cast off their thing, indicating that they'd love to stone him, but all there was dust. And they sort of just cuff the dust up into his face. The thing is, in a way, quite funny, but the intent is there. It's quite clear what they felt. They were angry, they were furious, and they wanted him done away with. And they would do it by stoning, if they could find a stone. And that's what's being said, you see. And we'll leave it there. But you can see again the hostility. They gave him audience unto the word Gentiles. In other words, this was the final breaking point, the final exasperation. He'd spoken things about the people at Jerusalem, said that God was against, you know, that they wouldn't receive the testimony about the Lord Jesus Christ, implying that they were all wrong, as they were. But you can see they were all about, and when it came to Gentiles, that was the end of it. And then we see that the Roman takes them away for safety. Well, we'll leave it there for now. I'll make a note of where we got to so that I know where it is.